On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Columnist, novelist, and satirist Carl Hiaasen is a Florida boy to the bone, born and raised and risen to fame in the glittering, swampy funk of South Florida. His best-selling novels, Striptease, Skinny Dip, Sick Puppy, Basket Case, and more, have taken devoted readers deep into the whacked and scuzzy side of the Florida life, the ragged, sagging, gator-wrestling underbelly of the Sunshine Paradise. In his new book, Nature Girl, a despicable Texas telemarketer gets dragged into a romp in the swamp and punished for his incivility with a taste of Florida's own. It is Down and Dirty, Laugh Out Loud, up next on Point, a conversation with Florida's one-of-a-kind novelist and humorist, Carl Hiaasen. Carl Hiaasen, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom.
How's the weather, my friend?
It's a little overcast, a little breezy. It's like 64, which means, of course, we got the heat on.
Right. And how about the fishing?
I haven't been fishing for a couple months. I need to get out there. But last time I was out, it was pretty good.
Okay. We're trying to get a fix on your Florida, and it's wild book after book. Here we are in Nature Girl, and I have to say, you had me just, I don't know if it's everybody's humor, but it's clearly a lot of people's, and it got to my funny bone page after page. This is a Florida where you have people, somebody here perishing in a freak tanning booth mishap.
Yes.
You've got the boys' college fund, $16,000-plus pulled right out of that old bank and invested in 307 Beanie Baby dolls, shrunk to $3,000 and put down as a payment on a Lexus coupe. You've got a guy coming out of prison, and the first words from his wife, Honey Santana, the lead actor in your new novel, her first words to her husband coming out of prison: if you ever run another load of weed, I'm going to cut off your fill-in-the-blank and grind it into snapper chum. Wow, you got some seedy territory down there.
Well, these are all very close to being real people, as most Floridians know. My books tend to be viewed as documentaries here, not so much as satire. And the news just keeps getting weirder, and the challenge is staying ahead of it. I mean, I'm fond of all those characters, as twisted as they are, but I've met various incarnations of them along the road.
So we're trying to figure out, at the end of all this, do you love Florida? Are you fed up with Florida? Where do you stand on
the great
state of Florida?
Both. I mean, I always tell people, I mean, I love the place, but I hate what they're doing to it. And I think that's entirely possible. And I think you can go around the country to find very special places that people absolutely love, and they absolutely cringe when they see what's happening there. And I think that's sort of a lot of people's reaction when they come to Florida. And for someone who's born and raised here, there are parts of it that are particularly ghastly. And I think that's a fuel for satire. I think most satire comes from anger and outrage and being ticked off.
And when you say you hate what they're doing to it, who's they, Carl Hiaasen?
Well, I mean, in particular, sort of the whole political engine in Florida is run by development and growth interests. Obviously, it's all about, you know, it's all about carving up as much of the green space as possible and selling it for the highest possible price. And if it's on the water, then it's even a bigger prize. And so there's very little attention paid to saving any of the green belt or any of what was here when I was a kid. It's all about real estate. It's all about moving property and bringing people in at the rate of about 1,000 a day. Mm-hmm. That's net moving into Florida, and that's even factoring in those who are passing away even as we speak.
So you're watching and judging and shooting your mouth and your pen off about it just right and left here, and Lord, it is effective. But when did you figure out that you're sort of that your meat was the seedy, the scuzzy, the skanky? I mean, when did you figure out that was your royal road to success and bestseller status?
Well, the scary part, Tom, is that's kind of the way I look at the world. I mean, I started out, I graduated the University of Florida, went right to work at a newspaper in Central Florida, and then shortly thereafter, the Miami Herald. And so the general news stories that come over the transom back from the days of the cocaine wars to now, Mark Foley, O.J. Simpson, you name it. I mean, there are almost every national story has some bleeds or oozes in some way into Florida and becomes a target for both the newspaper column and material for the novels.
Tell us about your story this time, Nature Girl. Introduce us, if you would, to Honey Santana. She's something else.
Yeah, she's one of my favorite characters, and one of the characters I could actually was fond of by the end of the book.
Her son says, "Mom, you're not bipolar, you're tripolar." Okay.
Yeah, possibly tripolar. She's a single mom living in a pretty remote area, Everglades City, which is a gorgeous place, but it requires some sturdiness to live there.
It's a real place, all the way down on the south, kind of, not the tip, but way
southwest,
down there by the Everglades. Yeah, southwest.
Yeah, it's on the southwest side. It's mm-hmm. It's mangrove jungle, creeks, bays. It's so easy to get lost over there. It's just a tough place, and the people who live there and have lived there for generations have had to be pretty tough, and mm-hmm. Honey's raising her son by herself. Her husband, as you mentioned, her ex-husband is an ex-smuggler. He's in town. He's a model citizen now, but like a lot of the folks of his generation, went and had a little 3 to 5 year sabbatical when he got caught with running some dope. And
what you say every self-respecting young Floridian at one point had to do was doing
in that part of the world. I mean, I was there. I was in Everglades City back in the early '80s when the DEA literally closed off the entire town and rounded up half the male population and threw them in paddy wagons. And they were commercial fishermen. They'd been offered a lot of money, and some of them couldn't say no.
Yep.
But those characters exist, and Honey is just. She's just trying to get by, and her son Fry, who I like a great deal, sort of the ambassador between, you know, his dad and his mom, and trying to balance things. But Honey has a short fuse and a long memory, and she gets one too many phone calls at dinner time from the telemarketing agencies, and she does what all of us have fantasized about doing, and that's tracking down the caller himself and his real name, finding out where he lives, calling him at his own house during dinner hour, and then selling him something he doesn't need and really can't afford, which is, in this case, a very harrowing echo tour to the 10,000 Islands.
An echo tour, as Honey Santana puts it together out of her double wide there in Everglades City. She reaches right out to Texas, cashes in her ex-husband's miles, and brings on the sucker, the telemarketer, the miserable, despicable sucker, and she gets him right out there. Her plan to let him know that you just can't be that uncivil and get away with it.
Yeah, in a way, she's kind of naive. She thinks she can actually talk sense into this guy whose name is Boyd Shreve, and he's sort of the quintessential slacker, and he was a difficult villain to draw because he was one of the few characters who I deliberately contrived that there would be less to him than meets the eye. I mean, he's as empty as they get, and he empty of soul and empty of heart, and he just is cruising through life, and he's not. She thinks if she shows him this beautiful, wonderful world. And a sunrise in the Everglades in the morning, and he can contemplate on his own fate and his own lack of civility, and he'll change. He'll be a changed person, which, of course, you and I know is probably not going to happen. But she carries this sort of almost innocence and naivete with her through life. She thinks she can actually make a difference. At one point, Honey says she's sort of trying to save the world one jerk at a time. And that's really how she looks at life.
She's going to truss him up and throw him on her kayak, and off they go. Carl, we want to hear more, but we've got listeners who want to speak with you already. Let me take a call, if I may, from Nashville. Olivia, you're on the air.
Oh, my goodness. Hi, boys. Let me tell you something. I've been reading this boy since he wrote Skinny Dip, and when he developed that scene where the fella usurped the garbage truck and dumped everything into the Porsche. This boy is good. Yeah. Yeah, he should be from Eastern Kentucky now. He should be from Eastern Kentucky where we've got real problems. But I just wanted to tell you, I mean, I don't call anybody, and I'm an old lady, but this fella has got it.
Olivia, I know exactly what you mean, but describe what makes it work. I mean, I was just hooting out loud right through this book. What is it? What is it that gets you going?
Honey, I got Skink. Skink is my man. I'm telling you, that boy, you know, he only appears occasionally. But when he appears, I have bought all these books, and I have passed them around to old country folks that literally laugh out loud, and I don't know what to say other than that. But
you say you're from Eastern Kentucky originally, so you know where things get down and out. Do you hear Carl Hiaasen making fun of that rough, you know, bottom edge of American life, or holding it up?
Absolutely not. That boy is saying, you better take care of it, or it ain't going to be around anymore. and that's what we feel. You know, you got to take care of the land, boys and girls. You've got to take care of it.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say, Olivia. And thank you for the call. You're very sweet.
Olivia,
all right, darling.
Wonderful to have you from Nashville there. And they're kind of the profile of your fan, Carl. They're ready to go where you go. Get as skinky and skanky as you want to be.
She was referring to this character who pops in and out of some of my novels, Skink, who is the fictitious former governor of Florida who went insane in the governor's mansion and running naked out into the woods and lives off roadkill now. And you would think that a character like that would have a somewhat limited a demographic appeal, but I get letters from literally all over the planet about that character. When am I bringing him back? What's he doing now? People, and he's, you know, he's a little bit of an outlaw, but his heart is in the right place, and I think that's what appeals to people about a lot of these characters. And Honey, in this novel, in Nature Girl, certainly her heart is in the right place.
Carl, I wonder if you could read a little bit for us. Take us into Nature Girl here. There's a bit where, Honey Santana's been getting ready to launch her ecotourism business out of her double-wide trailer. She's been, I think, growing out the hair on one leg to see if it might keep the mosquitoes off when they get out in the boondocks, and now she's trying something else here.
All right, okay, this section, I got you. So she's, now I haven't read this aloud, Tom, so this is going to be a new experience for me, too.
Okay. She's here with her son, Fry, who's your kind of buddy. She's had some trouble recently with her boss down at the fish market. He was groping, and she went after him with some kind of mallet. He ended up in trouble. And they're just kind of, is mother and son.
Yeah, she's got a little moment with her kid, mm-hmm. And they know something's going on, and they know something's going to be going on out in the swamps. And Fry's a pretty smart kid.
But she hasn't revealed to him just how wacky it might get out there.
And here he is. The boy went to pack while Honey stepped outside to test her latest mosquito remedy, citronella mixed with virgin olive oil, which she slathered on both legs. After several minutes, she decided that the night was too breezy for a bug census, so instead she began rehearsing the lecture she intended to lay upon Boyd Shreve, the man who'd called her a dried-up old skank. She planned to wait until the second day of the Echo Adventure, when they were so deep in the wilderness that Shreve wouldn't dare make a run for it. He'd have no choice but to sit and listen while Honey Santana straightened him out. The theme of her rebuke would be the erosion of manners in modern society, the decay of civility. Honey was prepared to accept responsibility for her own sharp words during the sales call. Perhaps she'd begin by apologizing for mentioning Shreve's mother. "That was wrong of me, Boyd, and I'm sorry, but I was upset, and now I want to tell you why." "Mom?" Fry's voice from behind the screen door. "Who are you talking to?" "Nobody. Come out here and sit." She scooted over to make a place for him on the top step of the trailer. His backpack was slung over one shoulder, and he was eating an apple. "When's your old man showing up?" she asked. 10 minutes. "Who are you talking to?" "Myself. Lots of perfectly sane people do that, Fry." Honey leaned against him. His hair was damp, and it smelled like her shampoo. She felt like hugging his neck and crying. "They had a plane up today," he said, "looking for some college girl who supposedly got snatched from one of the islands. Then her boyfriend calls up and says she's okay. She dumped him and took off with a poacher." Honey sniffled a laugh. "Sounds like true love."
And then they turn to gaze upon the wonderful nature mural that his mother has painted on the side of the trailer there, where she's got the telemarketer coming. "Your parrots turned out cool, Mom," he said. "The monkeys are killer, too." But everybody's scrabbling along here. Carl Heisman, we've got a lot of people who want to talk with you. Let me go to Buford, South Carolina, and Gretchen. Hi, Gretchen. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
We're good.
Hi, Gretchen.
I love the books. I'm halfway through Nature Girl. I bought it for my father for Christmas, but I had to read it first, of course. and I'll be through with it in no time. I think a lot of the appeal is these are the things that we'd love to do if we had the guts or, you know, nothing to lose.
What, you want to tie a telemarketer to the back of your kayak and dump him on an Everglades island, Gretchen?
Oh, most definitely.
Me too.
Telemarketers for sure. And actually, I think I'm a perfect reader because I was telling a friend the other day as we were driving through some of the low country here, which is so beautiful, and I said, you know, you could throw a body in here, and it would rot away, and no one would ever know. And she was quite surprised that I would even think of such a thing, but I think partly because of my reading material.
Right. You throw a body, and off it would go, and you're right in the spirit of Carl Heisman. Gretchen, thanks for that.
Carl, well, body dumping 101.
Yes, right.
There we go.
And you've got it front and center in here. Introduce us to the guy who does it, Sammy Tiger Tail.
Sammy's connected to a character who appeared in my very first novel called Tourist Season 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And Sammy's uncle Tommy was in that mm-hmm. novel.
Tommy Tiger Tail.
And he was sort of the bingo brains behind the Seminole gambling operation, which at that time, 20 years ago, was just bingo halls. And now, of course, it's expanded to the point where they just yesterday announced they're buying the entire Hard Rock casino and restaurant empire. So
worldwide will be owned by the Florida Seminoles? Then?
Everything except the one in Vegas, but all the others will be owned, including all the rock and roll memorabilia, which is ironic because Sammy, in my novel here,
the would-be guitarist,
has armed himself with a Mark Knopfler guitar, the great guitarist from Dire Straits. It's the only thing he wanted from the Hard Rock Casino in Fort Lauderdale was Mark Knopfler's guitar, which he's carrying with him into the 10,000 Islands. He's in retreat because he was raised by his father, who was white, and his mm-hmm. father died in a tragic incident at a gentleman's club in Fort Lauderdale. Oh. And we all know how
that would be a lap dancing club.
Well, this was actually in the mud wrestling pit.
Oh,
but,
excuse me. Yeah.
But never just as tragic. and so Sammy's stepmother drove him straight out to the Big Cypress Reservation and said, "You always wanted to be an Indian. Now go be an Indian."
Yeah.
And he's trying his hardest to do that. And he's got a tourist on an airboat ride out in the swamp, and the tourist is inconsiderate enough to expire of a heart attack.
A snake slaps up against him, and the big guy from Minnesota loses it right there.
He's actually frightened to death when a snake hits him. And so Sammy panics and takes the body deep into a place called Lossman's River, which if anybody read Peter Matheson's great mm-hmm. book, Killing Mr. Watson, was mm-hmm. featured in that book, and dumps the body and is now in hiding. And he's sort of on a collision course, Sammy is, with Honey and with some other characters that are all going to collide at an island in the 10,000 Islands called Dismal Key, which is a real place. I love the name of it, and mm-hmm. I went out there and looked at it, and it was suitably dismal, so I put it in the book.
And we get a wacko crescendo of high scuzzy humor, just kind of character on character laid on here in the Florida outback. But in a way, you describe this as not so much at the fringe, but kind of encroaching right on the mainstream. Let's take a call from Taos, New Mexico. Caleb's on the line. Hi, Caleb. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I grew up in Miami, as we called it.
That's right.
In the 40s, used to go over to South Beach when there was a hotel there during the war that had GIs in there, injured GIs, and South Beach had a dog track over there, and, you know, there was kooky people everywhere there, but, you know, they left me alone. I grew up in Coral Gables and pedaled my bicycle all around the golf courses out to Venetian Pool, pedal out there when they were building the causeway out to Key Biscayne, you know, and there were crazy people everywhere, but they left you alone, you know. And in the 60s, I paddled from Everglades City, or rather actually Florida City, down to, Flamingo up to Chokoloskee.
Yeah.
In a canoe. In the first 5 days, I never saw another human being. I don't think that's the case any longer.
Oh, you're getting right out toward Carl Hyazin territory.
No, it is. Sadly, you'd see some people, but that's great country, and that must have been a heck of a canoe trip, I'll
tell
you.
Well, there was a gentleman there that lived in the Keys, in the Everglades National Park, that had been grandfathered in, and he lived there until his death. He had life estate, lived in a small home there. Camped on the Watson place.
It sounds just like what Carl's got going on this time. You should check this out. Caleb, let me ask you, though. We can't help noticing that you're calling from New Mexico. So was it lovable kooky that you saw in Florida, or get out of there kooky?
Well, I went to college at University of Florida after living in Europe for a few years, and it just there are maybe five times as many people in the Miami area as there are in the state of New Mexico.
That's right. It's crowded.
And also we have no mosquitoes, no cockroaches, and no humidity. And so that chased me away. When I got out of the military, I drove a Coke truck and my route was Calle Ocho. And it was just the beginning of when the migration of the immigration of the Cubans along Calle Ocho, and I have some wonderful memories of meeting some people who were just so wonderfully excited about coming to the United States.
Now, you're too deep in Florida for me. What's Cayo Ocho?
8th Street.
Southwest 8th Street. Okay. That's the sort of the main drag of what we call Little Havana.
Well,
I had just met some really wonderful people that were just coming there at the time, you know, and then I had land up around Hawthorne, and I don't know whether University of Florida was Gainesville, Alachua County was dry when Mr. Hyacin went to school there, but it was when I did in the early 60s.
Oh, boy, Caleb, you've got us right out there in Carl Hyacin country on your Coke truck in Cayo Ocho. Carl, this is your terrain.
Yeah, but I can assure him that the University of Florida wasn't a dry county when I was there. Alachua County was anything but dry.
Yeah,
it was dry maybe one day a week by accident. Right. The rest of the time it was pretty wet.
Caleb, it's great to hear from you. Here we are in this world of these spirited degenerates and, shotgun-toting geezer sex fiends and just right on down and people loving it. Alice is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alice. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
It's a thrill to talk to you because in my family, our favorite book is Tourist Season. We lived in Miami for 20 years, and we love the way you just skewer the real gem of life in Miami, namely the Orange Bowl.
Oh, yeah, that was...
And,
you know, that it's sad because since I wrote that book, there's no Orange Bowl parade anymore.
We used to watch it on television and loved it. There was nothing trashier than the Orange Bowl Parade, and we grieve its loss.
It was kind of that kitschy kind of entertainment. And Tom, in that particular novel, the Orange Bowl Queen is kidnapped in a tasteful way.
That's surprising in your book.
Jimmy Buffett liked that book so much that he wrote a song about it called The Ballad of Skip Wiley, who was one of the eco terrorists who engineered that scheme.
So, Alice, does Carl Hyacin take you back to all that? Is it where you want to go?
Anytime I want to go back to Miami in my mind, I open up Tourist Season. Just a phrase from that book has entered our family lexicon. It's when the Cuban detective meets with the WASPI Orange Bowl Committee, and they introduce him as Jesus. And one of the guys on the committee says, "Why, that's just like our Jesus."
Oh, boy, that's great. Alice, thanks very much for your call. I want to get one more right here from Pocatello, Idaho. Wendell's calling. Wendell, you're on the air with Carl Hyacin.
Thank you. It's nice to hear from you. I'd just like to say thank you. I was raised in Central Florida,
and
I've read all of your books except your new one, and I'm headed for the store this afternoon to get it. I love what you do. I think it's magnificent.
Thank you, Wendell. Thanks a lot. It's just curious how all these people have gotten out. Wendell's in Pocatello, which is beautiful. Idaho's gorgeous. I mean, all these people have bolted.
Yeah, they've bolted. But, Wendell, I understand Carl Hyacin helped you through a tough time. Tell us about it.
Well, I might get a little teary, but I had a stroke 2 years ago, and I couldn't read, I couldn't write, and I couldn't talk. So, I'm a fan of his books. And reading his books through going to therapy and things like that and laughing and it's helped me read and write and talk again. So,
pulled you back out of that kind of stroke paralysis there on the rungs of Carl Hyacin's ladder.
I just love what he does. I was raised in the old Florida, and, you know, it's life is good.
That's good, Wendell. You doing okay now?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm doing fine. No problem.
Well, I'll be thinking of you
physically. Well, I thank you. You just keep writing, and I'll keep listening. Okay.
That's a promise. Thank you.
Reading. So, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to hear you on the radio.
It's great to have you, Wendell, and thanks so much for calling in. There's so many here. Let me go to one more, if I may. Beverly's calling from Isle of Palms, South Carolina. Hi, Bev. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a huge admirer of Carl, and I have read every thing I can get my hands on that he's ever written, and some more than once. Grew up in Florida and kind of all over. Left Florida because it isn't Florida anymore.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
Well, Florida, I think my impression of Hawaii is it tried to turn itself into the South Pacific, and then Florida tried to turn itself into Hawaii. Now I'm watching South Carolina trying to turn itself into South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
And I, you know, grew up in, by the way, also graduated from the University of Florida back when it was dry. But it wasn't very dry then. We used to be able to go out in the country and buy moonshine, you know, real, legitimate, off-the-shelf moonshine that came in little glass jars. And it would probably was one of the reasons why they did turn it into a wet county, because you're safer drinking.
Yeah,
right. Got to put a cork in the moonshine bottle.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the crowd at the Gator game if they were all on moonshine. That's a scary thought.
Beverly, thanks so much for your call. Carl Hyacin, what? I mean, you clearly share this kind of view of Florida as I'm not sure. Ruined would be the wrong word. Debauched, certainly, at the edges.
Yes, debauched is a good word, I think. But what all these people have in common is what I've been talking about, is the affection that never leaves. It really does become a state of mind, and there's so many great memories in all these great places, and then to see them slowly eroded and paved over and destroyed, and in some cases corrupted, is kind of heartbreaking. But they people who have been here and who have experienced all this always carry that special feeling with them wherever they end up.
And is the way of Florida the way of the country? I mean, Beverly sees it creeping right on up to South Carolina. Is the whole country going down your SCUS path?
I wouldn't say the whole country, but I said there's certain areas, certainly coastal areas, where there's waterfront property and there's anybody with an eye for a huge, usurious profit. You're going to have the same kind of engine of greed creeping into the political process. And it's true. I mean, Florida is they're tapping it out so fast that a lot of folks are looking for new places to exploit and develop, as just as she said, to sort of make them the next South Florida.
Carl Hyacin, I'd love it if you'd set up and read a bit more for us. There's a bit where Boyd Shreve, the despicable telemarketer, has been lured in by Honey Santana from Texas, along with his 6-foot mistress, who's grown pretty weary of him. But Eugenie Fonda's there. What, Honey's got her sort of faux eco-tour outfit set up in her double-wide trailer. They're settling down for the night. She's dressed up the bedroom in her trailer with the safari tent stuff, billows of muslin bed sheets tacked to the ceiling, and a faux cane nightstand. And, set up what we need to know and read for us, if you would.
Well, Boyd has come here with his girlfriend. This is the most ambitious thing Boyd's ever done in his life, was have an affair. He doesn't have much energy for anything in life, and he imagined this weekend was going to be beaches and tiki bars and, you know, a romantic Florida weekend. And now they've arrived in the 10,000 islands, and it's plain to him that this is not what he had in mind.
Honey has lured him down on a kind of a free come see the property telemarketing scam of her own.
It's exactly the typical real estate thing. We'll come down to town for a free weekend, sit through the sales pitch, and then go have some fun. And she's invented this place called Royal Gulf Hammocks. That she just made it up, and he thinks he's got to sit through the sales pitch. But now,
and her Dancing Flamingo Lodge.
The Dancing Flamingo Lodge. And here's Boyd sort of contemplating what he's gotten himself into.
Right.
The Dancing Flamingo Lodge, Shreve mused acidly. Try the Fleabag Flamingo. It was plain to him that the Royal Gulf Hammocks promotion was doomed. Only a certified moron would buy real estate from such a lame and bumbling outfit. He took his NASCAR toothbrush and travel tube of Colgate into the bathroom and went to work on his smile. When he came out, Eugenie was upright in bed, shedding her clothes. I had a god-awful nightmare, she said. I'm at the call center and I've got Bill frickin' Gates on the line, all hot to buy a timeshare at Port Aransas, but then that damn sacco crawls under my desk and starts licking my knees. Boyd, what does that big number 3 on your toothbrush mean? Shreve said, you're kidding me, right? Eugenie kicked off her panties. Okay, never mind. Come on, number 3 was Dale Earnhardt's number. And he is? Jeannie, that's not even funny, Shreve said. Whatever, I gotta take off my makeup. Hope renewed, Shreve slapped some cologne on his neck and dimmed the lantern. Kneeling on the floor, he hastily fished through the Orvis bag for his box of condoms. A black object under the bed caught his eye. It looked like a gun. Shreve was waving it around when Eugenie Fonda walked out of the bathroom. She stopped in her tracks. He was ready. "What's that for?" she asked. "Just in case. They got panthers down here, you know." "How'd you get it on the plane?" Shreve said, "I didn't. I bought it when we stopped at that mall." When Eugenie asked to hold it, he said, "No, it's loaded." Sounding, he was sure, as calm and knowledgeable about firearms as Van Bonneville would have been. She smiled. "I didn't know you were a gun guy, Boyd. It pays to be prepared. What is it, a 38? "A good guess," he said, having not a clue. Had Boyd Shreve been a gun guy, he would have known that what he'd found beneath Honey Santana's bed was actually a taser, a handheld shocking device used by police to subdue drunks and meth freaks. Instead of bullets, it fired 50,000 volts. Shreve coolly stashed it in his bag under a stack of Tommy Bahama shorts. "And that little thing will work on a big, hungry panther?" Eugenie asked. "Oh, yeah." She climbed into bed and tugged the covers up to her breasts. "You tired, Boyd?" "Not really." "Excellent. Get your butt over here."
And there we are. Everything's wonderful, or not really, at the Dancing Flamingo Lodge. And that 50,000-watt taser, well, let's just say Boyd's going to be intimately familiar with it before too long.
Yeah, he puts it in a bad place.
Oh, boy. Carl Hyacin reading from his new book, Nature Girl. Let's take a call from Manan, Idaho. Pam is on the line. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Carl. I just wanted to thank you for all of your books. You're my favorite author. I just finished Nature Girl on the plane in one shot on the way home. And, yeah, I'm a wildlife biologist, and as bad as some of the things I see get me, I read your stuff, and I get so relieved that I'm not there.
You'd rather be an idol.
Yeah, we've got our stuff, but you've cornered the market on them from what I can see.
Oh, it's not by choice. I just happen to live in this ongoing freak show down here, and it's the best I can do.
Pam, you're a wildlife biologist. Does what you see going on with the ecology make you want to strap a telemarketer across the hood of your car or anybody else and, you know, dress them down the way Carl Hyacin does?
It does. Most of all, when I grow up, I want to be skink.
Everybody.
I see. Everybody wants to be skink. He gets away with some things. I mean, that's the great thing about one of the selfish pleasures about these novels is I get to have my characters do and say things that I've always wanted to get away with doing and saying and have never been able to.
Yeah, and pretty soon it's all snapper chump. Pam, thanks very much for calling. Let me get a call from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Lenore's on the line. Hi, Lenore. You're on the air.
Hello. I want to credit Carl Hyacin with really turning my son onto reading with his novel Hoot.
Yeah.
And then Flush.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't talked at all about his writing for kids, but I was wondering, Carl, if you have plans to write any more for the youth market.
I do. Thank you for asking. I'm going to be starting another novel for young readers very soon. As soon as I sort of get through with the promotion for Nature Girl, I'm going to sit down and start working on it. I had great fun doing those books, and they were both of them sort of little pieces out of my own childhood, and I was just flabbergasted that they caught on the way they did. I mean, it was really just sort of an experiment that I was trying, and I've gotten just literally thousands of letters from kids all over the place, and it's been one of the most rewarding things I've ever done.
You don't pull any punches, and I think that appeals to young adolescents, so some of the outrageous stuff that goes on is just perfect for them.
Lenore, we just heard just a little taste of it, but as you may know from his adult books, Carl Hyacin's pretty racy, pretty ribald when he gets revved up in his adult books. Is there a flavor of that in the young? Is the pulling the punches the youth book echo?
There is absolutely a flavor of that, only it's not sexual, so that's appropriate. We have a number of Carl Hyacin's books on tape for listening to in the car, and I'm afraid we don't listen to them with my son. But I think there's a rawness to it, and there's that sense of humor that is just in a more appropriate areas. But just there's a little bit of off color to it, and kids love that.
Truth is that there's nothing they're going to see in any of those books they don't hear on the school bus. But I think that from the letters I get, what they say is it's the irreverent attitude, of course, is what they like. And they also like the fact that the kids in the novels care about something so deeply that they're going to go fight for it. In the case of Hoot, they're just trying to save these little owls from being bulldozed, and that these kids would put everything on the line to stop that from happening appeals very much to young readers, because they're very idealistic, they're very passionate about the environment, and they're much more educated about the environment than I was at that age.
Lenore, thanks so much for your call. Carl Hyacin, you famously wrote also about the Disney impact.
Oh, God, yes.
Team Rodent, very Hyacinian, if that's a word.
It was nonfiction. It was just a rant, and I was amazed they asked me to do it, that the publishers asked me to do it. And they said, do you have anything you can sort of rant and rave about in a short little series of books that we're doing? And, I mean, it was an illustrious line. I mean, Jimmy Carter was doing something. Right. I mean, they had a whole bunch of really classy people. How they found me, I don't know. And I said, well, I'd like to do a riff on Disney and its impact, not only in Florida, but just sort of some of the cultural issues that happen when a place is completely transformed by a company. And so I just went off on Disney for a while.
It's an empire. Everybody's seen, or most, many, its giant footprint in Florida. But among all the influences on Florida, how big that one? I mean, is Disney your mega villain, or is it just one among?
It's one, but you have to understand the scope of it because, I mean, I think the last figures for last year were like 48 million tourists. Had come through the sort of the Disney Universal access in Orlando. That's a ton of people, Tom, and not all of them leave without making footprints or leaving anything behind them, unfortunately. Yeah. Secondly, just the growth in the whole Orlando-Tampa corridor for that has turned that place into a metropolis as congested and it has all the problems, urban problems, that certainly Miami and Fort Lauderdale do. That whole area has been transformed. The Disney property is obviously beautiful, well-kept, and somewhat insulated, but the real world for the people that live in Central Florida is much, much different. It is sprawl from as far as the eye can see, from one end to the other, and all the problems that go with it.
Let's take a call from Virginia Beach. Scott's on the line. Hi, Scott. You're on the air with Carl Hyacin.
Hi. Thank you very much. Yeah. Carl, I love your books. They're terrific. And
thank you.
What a great approach. You look at government, you look at crazies, you look at the ecos. Is there anything that you run across that is off limits for you?
No, not really. I mean, I took on, in Basket Case, it was really took on the newspaper industry in a pretty lacerating way and biting the hand that feeds me pretty hard. I don't think there's anything that's off limits. I certainly think that humor has its limits. There are some headlines, and you know what I'm talking about, that you read every day, and there's no funny spin on them. They're just so sad and depressing and moving that the only way to write about that would be to write about it very seriously and to be tasteful about it. I mean, there's not a funny side to everything, but I think when you step back and look at the big picture, especially if you're talking about, for instance, political corruption, which, where you have comic characters like Jack Abramoff surfacing and
fellow Floridian Mark Foley.
Mark Foley, for heaven's sakes. I mean, he wasn't from Idaho. He was from right in our backyard. When you have so much of that happening, I saw a survey the other day that the Justice Department did on corruption prosecutions. South Florida led the whole nation over the last 5 years by a couple hundred cases. It demonstrably the most corrupt place in the country, which is saying something. I mean, that's ahead of Washington, D.C. This is not just something I've invented. It's not a made-up scenario. This is what we deal with every day, and these are our headlines. And if you're a novelist, that's where you have to go to sort of poach your material.
And yet you love Florida, and we can feel it. What about your outgoing governor, Jeb Bush? Give us some sense of him. I mean, he's big story in the front of the Wall Street Journal the other day saying...
Yeah,
Jeb Bush has figured out how to be conservative and popular, numbers a whole lot better than his older brother, George W., in the White House. What do you make of Jeb Bush?
Well, I mean, I think Kinky Friedman's numbers are probably better than the president's numbers right now. And Kinky's a friend of mine, I can say that. But I think that Jeb is, I will say, although we disagree politically on many, many issues and have, I'll tell you this, he's one of the reason the people of Florida like him is not because of the conservative ideology. He works hard. Dawn to dusk, he was there through all the hurricanes. He rolls up his sleeves. He gets around. He works like a dog. I mean, he reads. He's smart. He's politically astute. He certainly had made some incredible bonehead appointments over this his tenure as governor, and I'm sure those will be discussed if he runs for higher office.
Do you think he will one day? Will he gun for the White House?
I think it's almost inevitable, Tom. I think that because he is so popular, and he's a rare thing right now. He's an incredibly popular Republican, and after the last election, those are not easy to find. This is a state, by the way, that has more registered Democrats than Republican, yeah. And Jeb got reelected very, very easily. So there was a tremendous crossover appeal. Where he's messed up and really hurt himself is the Terri Schiavo case. And some of the political appointments he made, for instance, to the head of the Department of Children and Families, mm-hmm. which is in shambles where it's just one tragedy after another with Florida's most vulnerable citizens, kids, because of complete inept management in that department. And that was one of his campaign promises to clean that mess up, and it actually got worse. Mm. So there are spots where he's vulnerable, but overall he's popular because, I mean, he really is out there working hard, and people appreciate that. They may not agree with him politically on everything, and there are lots of polls suggest that they do not, but just as a hard-working governor, he's won a lot of support from both sides.
There's the word from Carl Hiaasen, something to contemplate. And here you are with this deep kind of affinity, affection, I don't know, affinity with the deep, comically, grossly debased, loving Florida, even as you bemoan a lot of things about it. What's your perfect Florida day, Carl Hiaasen?
Well, my perfect Florida day would be walking outside and seeing bumper to bumper northbound on I-95. That would be my perfect Florida day. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But my perfect Florida day would be probably fishing down in the Keys on my little skiff down there back in Florida Bay or back in Everglades National Park, just poling around in shallow water and away from everything. And there are places back there, Tom, and you can go, and places not far from where certainly where Honey Santana lives, where it looks just like it did 1,000 years ago. And it's pretty amazing. And it sort of reminds you what a special place this was. And it also reminds you why it's always attracted people and scoundrels and scallywags, as well as just dreamers, people who had this very romantic vision of a very beautiful place. And they got here and they found it was a little tougher than they thought. And this is true 200 years ago, and it's true today. They get here, and it's a little tougher road than they thought it was going to be.
But boy, oh boy, a lot of laughs along the way when it's your road. The new book is Nature Girl. Carl Hiaasen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. It was fun.
And glad to have you. I want to close this hour with The Ballad of Skip Wiley, a song Jimmy Buffett wrote for a character in Carl Hiaasen's novel The Tourist Season. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
He's a man on a mission, wild as a ricochet. Picture if you can when the Everglades ran from the Gulf Coast to Biscayne Bay. He's gonna give it back to the Gators, like the tourist stuff in theme parks and zoos. He's fishing me for lunch at the Reptiles Brunch, where the barometer soup is used.